Welcome to Slate's I Have to Ask. I'm Isaac Chotiner. My guest today is Ross Douthat, an op-ed columnist at the New York Times and the author of the new book, To Change the Church, Pope Francis and the Future of Catholicism. Douthat, a believing Catholic and social conservative, takes a critical look at the very popular Pope and explains why he thinks some of the changes the Church is considering could be detrimental to his faith. Ross Douthat joins me from Slate Studios in Brooklyn. Ross, hi.
Hi, Isaac. How are you?
I'm great. Thanks for coming on the program. I want to start by actually reading you a passage from your book and getting your opinion on
it. I have no objection to that.
Okay. Well, this is on page 13 for readers reading along at home, as I'm sure most of them are already. Quote, "But what happens when a pope sets out to defy this reality, to slip through the bars and evade the constraints, to act in the way that a watching world, and above all a watching media, seems to want the man at the center of the earthly church to act? What happens when a pope decides that he can deal with the church's crisis, its deep divisions, in a swift reforming march and reshape Catholicism according to his vision?" Now, when I read that passage, the person I was thinking about was not Pope Francis, but someone else who finds himself in a very powerful office and faced with constraints and seems to want to break out of those constraints. And so my first question for you is, did that comparison occur to you too? And how do you see Francis and Trump as two figures placed in these very powerful positions who are sort of fighting against tradition of the offices they hold?
I did see that comparison. It's a very fraught one, of course, because there are some obvious moral differences between Pope Francis and Donald Trump. And there are lots of practical differences in terms of their, you know, to the extent that you can say that the Pope has a policy agenda, it's pretty much diametrically opposed to the Trump agenda on all fronts, with issues like migration and immigration being sort of the most telling example. But in their relationship to their institutions, I think, yes, they are fairly similar figures. And they're both sort of coming in at a general moment in Western life where sort of institutions are tarnished and mistrusted. And, you know, in the case of Donald Trump, he comes into the U.S. government at the tail end of this era of the Iraq War, the financial crisis, and everything else. And in the case of Pope Francis, he comes into a church that has struggled mightily to deal with the cultural changes ushered in by the sexual revolution and sort of, you know, broad economic changes as well, and that spent the last 10 years in the shadow of, you know, a totally awful sex abuse crisis. So they're both sort of figures coming into these institutions who then have a kind of, let's say, relaxed attitude towards the norms that govern the life of a president or the life of a pope, and are sort of interested in shaking things up in various ways. And I think you could argue that there's a kind of implicit make Catholicism great again aspect of the Pope's agenda. Although I think, you know, to be kinder to it, you'd frame it as, you know, make Catholicism Christian again or something. So there are real parallels. And then the difference, the further difference beyond the obvious ones, is that I think Francis has had a more definite idea of what he wants to do with his office. I think, you know, Trump had this sort of general populist agenda, but has not been particularly adept at using the levers of power in Washington. He's been stymied on various fronts and just sort of exists at the moment as a kind of ranting figure on Twitter, whereas Francis, as I try and describe in my book, is a very effective he's a very effective populist, a very effective disruptor in certain ways. And so he has moved in all kinds of ways internally and sort of created the context for what are potentially real and substantial changes, the likes of which Catholicism hasn't seen since the Second Vatican Council, and depending on how you argue things, further back.
Well, so one of the things that's interesting reading the book is that, you know, for people who don't know your writing in the New York Times, you're a very strident critic of the president, and this book is obviously very, very critical of the Pope. And so it seems underlaying both critiques is not just sort of a policy critique of the Pope's policies, although you do that in the book, or the president's policies, but that there's something about maybe sort of going against these institutional norms that you find comforting either as a Catholic or as an American that worries you. Do you think that's fair?
I think that's somewhat fair. I think that my view of Trump, like my view of Francis, has been that the problems that led to their respective elections were real problems that shouldn't be minimized. And, you know, in the case of Catholicism, the sex abuse crisis was an awful thing. The total misgovernment of the Vatican under Benedict was, you know, a lesser but still significantly bad thing. And, you know, and the gulf between late modern life and the teachings of the Catholic Church was a real gulf that neither John Paul II, who was very popular, nor Benedict, who was less popular, had found a way to bridge. So as I would have been open to a populist other than Donald Trump, I tried, you know, in spite of my conservatism, to be sort of open to the idea of a reforming pope. And as I say in the book, there are elements of the Francis agenda, including things that are not sort of consonant with the Republican Party's platform and so on, that I'm not only fine with, I actually admire. But as a Catholic, you know, more so even than as an American, right? I mean, I think the American Constitution is a wonderful thing, but also a contingent thing. I think the sort of basic teachings of the Catholic Church are sort of, you know, deep absolute truths that the Church is charged with maintaining. And so to the extent that you have a figure who sees it as his mission to sort of disrupt those teachings, I look askance at that. I see it as something that potentially costs much more for the Church as an institution than it gains.
So what specifically are you concerned about? That what aspects of the Francis agenda, if sort of fully enacted, are you most concerned about as a Catholic?
I mean, I think the issue that he picked as sort of his entering wedge for reform, the opening of communion for people who, Catholics who are divorced and remarried and have not been able to get an annulment of their declaring that their first marriage is invalid. That issue from the beginning, I saw as really, you know, a reform that ought to be impossible for a church that sees itself as being true, you know, in some sense, however compromised, to the very real radicalism of Jesus's message in the New Testament. So in that sense, There's a story about Catholicism, particularly a story that I think Protestants often tend to tell, where, you know, the Church has sort of piled all these man-made, invented things on top of the purity of Jesus's message. But a big part of what has always made me feel good about being a Catholic, made me feel like I have ended up in what might actually be the one true Church, is the fact that on a lot of the sort of stranger, harder parts of the gospel, Catholicism has held close to what Jesus actually said in ways that other Christian churches haven't. And, you know, the indissolubility of marriage, which when Jesus sort of expressed this, even his disciples were sort of taken aback. So in that sense, the divorce and remarriage thing is clearly a case where, you know, Francis wants a kind of truce with post-sexual revolution culture. And since I live in that culture too, I completely understand the impulse. But I think it ends in a kind of betrayal, not only of sort of church teaching in some abstract way, but of the radicalism of the gospel that the church is charged with protecting and transmitting.
Putting aside, I don't think you and I are going to agree about sort of whether there's some fundamental truth to the message about divorce that you're reading and that I might not agree with. But what I am curious about is sort of how you see something like divorce in the context of a modern society like 2018. And so you have Catholic people who are in a marriage and things go awry, as things do. What sort of practically speaking is your message to those people, given what you're saying in the book?
I mean, it depends what situation they're in, right? I think my general message is that many more marriages are worth saving than are actually saved in our society. So I have a general pro-marriage, anti-divorce bias, and I think that that sort of our society's general comfort with divorce is a moral mistake that has consequences for children especially, but for, you know, entire family networks that we don't sufficiently reckon with. So that's sort of my general view, and obviously that's a sociological view as well as a moral and theological view that
right.
informs my view. You know, for people whose marriages do break up, I think that, you know, the church has become much more flexible in various ways, especially in the United States, on annulment policy and the grounds for which annulments are granted. And I have mixed feelings about that, but I think it's an understandable shift that is much, you know, that is sort of trying to, in effect, accommodate the reality that we all live with without doing so in a way that sort of breaks faith with what Jesus is saying. So, you know, in some cases, I would say that people in that situation should pursue the process of an annulment. And then for people who do not or cannot, or sort of, you know, the kind of people that I think the Pope is ultimately has in mind, I don't think it is, in fact, unreasonable for the church to ask people to abstain from Holy Communion. You know, it doesn't mean that they always will. I, again, personally have undoubtedly taken Holy Communion in contexts where I shouldn't. You know, everybody's life is complicated and messy and so on.
Let's hear about those.
And everybody's relationship with their church is complicated and messy and so on. But for the church itself to essentially either drop the teaching entirely or sort of put it away in a book somewhere in the Vatican as this kind of ideal that no one can reach, I think is a huge cultural abdication that has costs for not just sort of people who find themselves in these genuinely hard situations, but people getting married, contemplating marriage right now, people trying to make their marriages stay together and so on. And my parents are divorced and my grandparents were divorced before them. And I understand the hardship that a teaching like this can impose on people and the distance it can seem to create between them and God. But at the same time, I also understand the costs of divorce for the people who live with it who aren't the couple involved, and that, you know, there's a social value as well as, a moral and theological value in having one institution, this institution that, again, claims to be the custodian of God's actual revelation to humanity, holding to indissolubility when all the rest of the culture has just decided to deal with people breaking their vows and leaving their children potentially with a kind of shrug.
And so is your sort of fear if the changes Francis wants to put in the church move forward is that essentially, it just on a very practical level, again, not talking about sort of the truths of the church that you feel may be being betrayed in some way, but that essentially these compromises that you see modern society as having made about things like divorce are just, you know, that the church could sort of function as a necessary bulwark against them, and that, you know.
Yeah, I don't see any gain to society in Roman Catholicism becoming a kind of therapeutic chaplaincy to post-sexual revolution society. And I don't see anything in Western society right now, our society of sort of Me Too angst and, you know, low birth rates and low marriage rates and general anomie, that suggests that we've achieved this amazing social model that the Catholic Church needs to get up to speed and adapt to. I think there are obviously things about modern life that the church can and should learn from, and that the church has been far too harsh and rigorous and cruel at various times in the past. But looking at the correlations of forces right now, I think sort of, yes, snuffing out the Catholic critique of what seems to me a sort of decadent and flailing civilization doesn't seem to do anybody any practical good.
I was waiting how long you would tell you would say the word decadent. We're not that far in. That's good. But let me ask you one other.
It's a useful word.
No, I agree with you. Even if I'm not, but no, I mean it's hard to deny that we've become decadent after the last. Anyone who doubted,
I think
that
the Trump phenomenon
level,
has convinced even liberals that decadent is a useful word for our situation.
No, that's I can't argue with that. What do you think the church's teaching should be on issues of gay marriage and gay rights generally?
I mean, I think that, as in certain ways, as with divorce and remarriage, I think the church has needed to and probably continues to need to adapt reasonably to the realities of sort of post-closet life and the reality of homosexuality as a phenomenon that let me rephrase that slightly, the reality of gay people as a class whom Christians and Catholics have often treated cruelly in the past. And in that sense, the general rhetoric that Pope Francis uses, the rhetoric of mercy and accompaniment and so on, I think is entirely appropriate for the church. But I don't think the church can bless same-sex unions, and for the same reason that I don't think it can bless second marriages. And I think that ultimately the Christian vision of sexuality, the New Testament vision, is not compatible with same-sex marriage, and I don't see a way to change that, again, without entering into a kind of deception, basically.
When we were talking about Trump and Pope Francis earlier, and you were saying that, Trump had been elected after all these sort of societal problems that you thought that needed to be addressed somehow, and Francis also was chosen after the crisis of child sex abuse. One of the interesting sort of through lines there is that, I think Trump's critics would say he actually hasn't solved any of the problems he was elected to solve and may make some of them worse. And what's interesting is that there's a sort of growing critique of the way Francis is dealing with the sex abuse crisis, where it's the one issue that he seems to not get great press on. And it's the one issue where he doesn't seem to have kind of the common touch in speaking about it. And so I was wondering why you think he hasn't been able to sort of master that issue the way he has others, and two, how you think, just in terms of the policies he's tried to implement, he's dealt with the crisis.
Well, I think it's a case study in sort of the limits of a very personalized and charismatic style of leadership. I think Francis has in certain ways done things that the last couple popes were unwilling to do. He's actually gone in and removed bishops in cases where bishops had sort of participated in a cover-up or otherwise mishandled sex abuse allegations. And that's a good thing, and it's a necessary step. I think generally Pope Benedict did a good job sort of cleaning up the way the church handled abusive priests, but didn't go far enough in how he handled bishops who enabled them. And Francis has gone a little further, but he's gone that way in a sort of personalized way, where there are sort of specific cases and specific bishops where he'll act. But then if he has sort of personal reasons of loyalty or friendship as he, or sort of where he feels like his credibility is invested, as in some of these recent cases in Chile, especially, where he had a kind of disastrous visit, then he can just seem sort of stubborn and out of touch on the issue. And what there hasn't been clearly is a sort of structural breakthrough in terms of how the church handles not just priests, but bishops. And that's true sort of in a lot of areas in the Vatican. The Pope was elected, ultimately the cardinals who elected him wanted someone to clean up Vatican finances, sort of reform the bureaucracy, which is really not a bureaucracy, but a kind of Renaissance court. And Francis has come in and, given a lot of sort of moralistic speeches to members of the Curia and made a few sort of high profile moves and firings and so on. But then on a sort of day-to-day level, very little has changed. A lot of the sort of figures who were prominent and incompetent or corrupt under Benedict are there. Some figures who had lost favor have sort of come back as part of Francis's court. And there is, there's once again, with some of Francis's allies, a kind of miasma of corruption that extends beyond just the sex abuse crisis. So it is, in a sense, again, what you'd kind of expect from a populist style of leadership and its weaknesses. You get, a certain kind of very strong sort of moralistic rhetoric and some sort of interesting and important high-profile moves, but the sort of institutional side of things is something that Francis just hasn't been interested in or effective in dealing with. And where he has been, he's preferred, as I said earlier, to sort of spend his energy seeking this kind of broader moral theological shift on culture war issues.
We're not even getting the good moralistic rhetoric here, unfortunately.
Well, we got it initially, right? But yeah, in the recent cases, the Latin American cases, you had, he basically sort of critiqued the people who were critiquing this bishop.
Oh, I meant in terms of Trump.
Calumny. He
In terms of Trump, we weren't getting the moralistic.
Drain the swamp, man. Drain the swamp is the moralistic rhetoric. But yes, Trump is not delivering on even the moral vision of populism. I think that's fair to say.
I interviewed Michael Gerson, who's an evangelical conservative, but also anti-Trump, who wrote a cover story for The Atlantic, I think last month, about evangelicals essentially selling their soul to Trump. And one of the points he made when I talked to him, and he may make in the piece too, I'm forgetting which is which, but is essentially that he thinks Catholics have resisted Trump better than evangelicals. And his reason for it was essentially that the Catholic Church teaches all these things on a variety of issues, including sort of a much more pro-immigrant stance, for example, and that the fact that there was this centralized church that was preaching these things, some of which were at war with Trump's message, had sort of kept Catholics from falling prey to Trumpism the way evangelicals had. And I'm curious how that lines up with your own analysis.
I think there's some truth to it. Although, you know, Trump had plenty of especially white Catholic voters who supported him. I think one other thing that is true of Catholicism is that the way the church is structured doesn't create these kind of entrepreneurial pastors seeking a certain kind of political influence. You know, the bishops of the Catholic Church in the United States run the gamut from liberal to conservative, but they're all sort of embedded in this structure that doesn't reward necessarily the kind of, you know, the kind of effective freelancing and influence courting that you see from, you know, from Jerry Falwell Jr. and figures like that. And, you know, a big part of why we associate evangelicals with defenses of Trump in a way that we don't Catholics. It's not just that more evangelicals voted for him. It's also that you have these high profile figures who are sort of self-appointed leaders of evangelicalism who see a percentage in being invited to the White House and being invited on TV to raise their leadership profiles while making the case for Trump and so on. And the Catholic hierarchy does provide, I think, a certain protection against that kind of temptation for influence seeking. And also Gerson is right that there is sort of a different sense of sort of what Christian social teaching is somewhat in the church that tempers to some extent the pull of sort of a defensive partisanship of the kind that led people to support Trump. But you do have lots of pro-Trump conservative Catholics who support him just for exactly the same reasons that I think the more sincere evangelicals do, just this sense of sort of embattlement in a hostile liberal culture, this anxiety about the Obama administration's various moves that affected religious institutions. And, you know, those Catholics in that world, you do sometimes get the sort of egregious excuse making of the kind you get from evangelicals, where evangelicals might compare Trump to King David, and Catholics might compare him to Constantine, for instance. And so there are some overlaps and parallels. And I am a little bit distinctive in being critical of both the Pope and the President. I think many of Francis's sharpest critics, especially among traditionalist Catholics, have had a kind of at least pragmatic support for Trump.
Do you feel embattled in liberal culture as a conservative who writes for the New York Times and engages with pop culture a lot? I mean, you review films and so on.
I try not to feel too embattled. I don't think that's sort of a healthy approach for someone who writes for a newspaper like the New York Times to take. And so, I mean, that means in part that I try and avoid sort of wallowing in things that might make me feel too embattled. You don't want to spend hours in the comment threads or reading your mentions on Twitter because it can sort of encourage a bunker mentality in its own right. But I'm also not, you know, I'm in a kind of privileged position and I'm not running a Christian or conservative institution. And I think I would feel probably more embattled, or I would have certainly in the Obama era, if I were a, you know, president of an evangelical or Catholic college looking at, you know, regulations coming down from the Department of Health and Human Services. You know, there are lots of positions of institutional authority where the tension between sort of liberal policy and liberal cultural goals and traditional Christian teaching is very sharply felt. And the position of newspaper columnist isn't quite one of them because, after all, you know, in part, I'm at the Times in order to sort of make manifest that tension because it's hopefully leads to good columns and interesting arguments.
There's been a lot of debate about liberal institutions hiring conservative writers and publishing conservative op-eds. We've seen this at the New York Times after they hired your colleague Brett Stevens. We've seen it with a number of op-eds the New York Times opinion page has run. We've seen it recently at the Atlantic Monthly, who hired a man named Kevin Williamson, who was formerly of National Review. I guess my question for you is, obviously I'm not going to ask you to criticize your colleagues, but
I appreciate it.
Yeah. Well, no, I mean, it's interesting because it feels like there's this thing going on where after Trump's election, I think a lot of people on the left or in liberal institutions felt like we're missing out. We're not getting what's going on in real America, which is why we saw 10,000 pieces about, you know, going to diners and talking to Trump voters. And so I think it's led to more openness to higher conservative voices at mainstream institutions. But the irony seems to me to be, if this is an irony, that these people are not pro-Trump conservatives. They are anti-Trump conservatives. I think the thinking probably being that among, you know, people who decide these things, that there are no really smart pro-Trump arguments. And so I'm wondering of what you think of the way many of these liberal institutions have reacted, which is to say we need to hear more conservative voices, and at the same time to say, but we're not going to bring in Trump supporters.
I think, first of all, the Trump phenomenon just sort of creates a basic dilemma for sort of journalistic institutions that aspire to have diversity of opinion and don't want to just be defined as liberal institutions, which is that, as you say, most of the conservative commentariat, independent of their specific policy views, was anti-Trump. So libertarians were anti-Trump, neoconservatives were anti-Trump, so I guess social conservatives like myself were anti-Trump. So wherever you go looking for ideological diversity, whatever piece of the conservative worldview you think your readers should hear more from, you are going to have a dearth of pro-Trump columnists. Now, it doesn't mean that they can't be found. There are some smart pro-Trump columnists, although I do think even the smartest ones end up defending Trumpism as an abstraction more than the man himself. But it is a challenge to it's a shallow pool of writers and thinkers who have the chops that you want to sort of especially engage with a more liberal readership and also support Trump. So that's clearly just a sort of baseline dilemma. Now, independent of that dilemma, I don't think that ideological diversity in these institutions is a good thing just because it sort of helps you understand what Trump voters per se were thinking. I think it just sort of expands, it's good to expand your political horizons generally in the aftermath of an event like the Trump election that was so shocking, but that is also sort of part of this general wave of disruption and political uncertainty all across the United States and Western Europe. So I think that there's value in hiring more people from the right, even if they don't technically speak for Trump voters in a direct way, because they do speak to ideas and concepts and realities that I think sort of have slipped a little bit out of the grasp of an elite liberal culture that felt a little too comfortable with the idea that it had sort of achieved a kind of end of history position from which it could just pass judgment on everything outside it. And I think, in addition, that extends to voices further to the left. So my view is a sort of ecumenical view that that the people who complain when conservatives are hired at these places and say, well, why don't you hire more socialists and anarchists and so on, have a totally reasonable point. And in my ideal world, institutions like my own would have more conservatives and also more people who are left-wing and also more people who are just sort of eccentric. And in that sense, I guess I can say, you know, this is something specific to the Times. I was unhappy in the sort of quick arc of the woman we hired from this, you know, the sort of weird world of net free speech, you know, absolutist who turned out to have this weird friendship with a neo-Nazi. I think it was totally understandable why we parted ways with her, but it was also an example of how, you know, once you get a little bit beyond the world of the journalistic clerisy, you do get people who, you know, don't play by the rules and have weird friendships and say offensive things and so on. But you also get opinions and ideas that are useful for understanding the world we live in. So I generally like the idea of outlets having the courage to sort of take risks with people from all different parts of the political spectrum, conservatism included, but not at all limited to conservatism.
I agree with you that bringing in conservatives can still serve a purpose, even if those conservatives are not pro-Trump conservatives, and that opening ourselves up to different voices is, you know, is important. I think that some of the people who've been hired, I'm not talking about the Times per se, just generally, is that you see a lot of conservatives who have the same take on Trump that I have or a bunch of liberal writers might have. And in fact, the ways in which they're conservative do not represent sort of 40% of the country, but represent just the other side of the elite consensus. So, you know, they dislike Trump, but they're extremely hawkish on foreign policy, or they dislike Trump, but they're – I'm trying to think what a different example would be.
They dislike Trump, but they're for free trade. They dislike Trump.
Yes, fine.
Right.
They're in favor of increased immigration and so on.
And you have – right. And you have extreme cases like Jennifer Rubin, who is sort of still notionally a conservative blogger for The Washington Post, who in the age of Trump is just simply against anything that, you know, has sort of ceased to become a conservative. And I'm not casting aspersions on her motives. I think something like the Trump election can, you know, cause people to evolve and change in all kinds of ways. But yeah, she but her pieces for the Post do not, in spite of sort of her technical conservative label, don't represent sort of massive diversity, a major shift in diversity of opinion. I agree.
Is there anyone though that you, I mean, do you, I don't think you answered the sort of question of whether you think that the Times should hire sort of a pro-Trump conservative. And I guess that the obvious follow-up is, are there people that you see making the case for Trump that you read, that you find intelligent or interesting, or are the conservatives that you read and find interesting ones who, like yourself, I think, kind of recognize certain aspects of what Trumpism perhaps could have been as being more appealing than kind of Paul Ryanism to aspects of the Republican Party, but who was deeply opposed to the man himself and many of the things he stands for?
Yeah, I mean, I guess if you asked me to sort of cite my favorite pro-Trump columnists, or not columnists, but sort of writers on the right, the list would include Dan McCarthy, the editor of Modern Age, who did a piece for us sort of defending Trump's trade policy, and a piece for the Times, I mean, and I had him in to do a larger dialogue about the Trump era. He's an incredibly smart guy, very good writer. Christopher Caldwell was sort of, he hasn't written as much about Trump, but he was sort of, again, pro-Trump, I think, at least tacitly during the campaign, and he's one of the best conservative writers there is. Someone who doesn't write as much about day-to-day politics, but Helen Andrews, who's a young, a younger conservative writer who writes a lot about literature and ideas for a bunch of different outlets. I think she was sort of tacitly pro-Trump. But I would say, as I said before, that as I list these names and I think about their writing, in many situations, they are, again, defending a sort of idea of Trumpism that seems a little bit removed from the man himself. And I think it's a big challenge to give someone a column and expect them to sort of go week by week defending things that Trump does week by week, because I do think it's, you know, it's hard to find, to my mind, an intellectually coherent case for not some macro level stuff, but the day to day workings of this administration. So that then creates again, a challenge for outlets, because if you're hiring someone as a columnist, you aren't just hiring them to write about sort of big picture stuff and, you know, I'm in favor of populism writ large, or I'm pro-Brexit. You're asking them to write about the week in, week out stuff of Washington politics. And I can't think of a writer who week in and week out has defended Trump and I have found persuasive at a level that I would want to read as a regular columnist.
I think part of the issue in terms of why people on the left are so angry at some of these hires and why other people defend it and sort of ideological diversity is, and I myself feel a little bit torn about this, is that I both feel that I want to read people who have different opinions of me. Although, I mean, I think the value of that maybe has been overstated by everyone, and that, mm-hmm. you know, we all like reading people we agree with too. But I do think it's good to have some level of ideological diversity. I also feel like
nobody agrees with me, so I don't really know what that's like, but I'll take your word for it.
Okay. Yeah. The besieged intellectual. Right. I guess I also sort of feel like we have a president who I find to be a racist and who is enacting an agenda that I think is in many ways bigoted. And I realize this all comes down to definitions of what's racist or what's not. But when I see a writer being hired who wrote something that I perceive as bigoted in some way, part of me just feels like, you know what, like enough, like just you do that now in modern society, given what's going on, and you lose your chance to write for serious publications. And again, I mean, this can turn into a debate about, well, then what is racist or what is not racist. But I also think that one of the frustration of people on the left is that about people that kind of are broadly agreed to be racist or have expressed racist thought, that conservatives who rant about political correctness or who say we need ideological diversity will not just draw a line and say, you know what, this is unacceptable. We are not going to support this person getting a job somewhere. And I think that's where a lot of the sort of tension and misunderstanding comes in.
I agree, but there's also a lot of there's a lot of variation in the reasons why liberals seem to get angry too, right? So I mean, you're bringing up race because I assume because Kevin Williamson is the new hire at The Atlantic, and there's a quote from the beginning of a piece that he wrote many years ago for National Review that seems, you know, where he's being accosted by a young black kid, and he describes the young black kid in what seems like racist language to people. But when Bret Stephens was hired at The Times, the objection to him was all about his views on climate change. And, you know, the freak out about Barry Weiss, my other colleague recently, was sort of about racism in some loose sense, where she had, you know, written this tweet about an Olympian who wasn't an immigrant, who was the child of immigrants and so on. And I know that this was sort of a proxy for larger disagreements with her writing. But I don't think it's just, I guess I'm saying, I don't think it's just a case of sort of liberals drawing the line about race. I think there's an attempt to just draw a lot of lines.
I agree with that. I think that's true.
And to say, look, that, you know, you have to have, you know, there are certain things that are not negotiable, and the list is expanding. And I mean, this is sort of, you know, not to go all that's how you got Trump on you, but there is a sense in which, you know, liberalism has been on the cultural ascendance for the last 10 or 15 years. And part of its cultural ascendance has been trying to take previous lines that it has sort of drawn to exclude, for instance, overt racists from debate that most of us agree are good lines, and expand the definition of racism and so on. And the other difficulty with this is sort of an internet era difficulty, right? Which is that, you know, I mean, Kevin Williamson has written a million words about a million subjects over a long and varied journalistic career. And you know, my impression of some of the rage against him is that it takes, you know, it finds his most trollish tweet and his most insensitive passage and so on, and it builds a case for Kevin Williamson, you know, terrible person. Kevin Williamson is, in fact, a kind of, you know, he's a misanthrope. That's his writing style. And he's it's a distinctive kind of thing. And I think, you know, he does it very well. And he writes about the white underclass from which he comes in much the same critical way that he writes about the black underclass, which is, again, something that makes him kind of interesting among conservatives who have a tendency to criticize the black underclass and romanticize the white underclass. So I'm just, I have, as, you know, someone who tweets and writes myself, a certain discomfort with the tendency to say, well, we can explain a writer's fitness or unfitness for society by finding the most offensive things he's ever said, rather than, you know, looking at what is interesting and distinctive about his entire body of work.
Yeah. I mean, again, it's lines, and it's how bad you think those few things that you're picking out from a body of work are, I guess. But I guess, let me ask you this. I mean, you say people who've written hundreds of thousands of words or so on. I mean, you've written hundreds of thousands of words. You are a conservative columnist. You have views that I think a lot of liberal readers disagree with. You don't seem to have faced a Kevin Williamson type backlash, or a backlash that Bret Stephens faced when he joined the Times. And I'm wondering why you think that is.
Well, part of it is that I joined the Times at a period when I was unknown and very young, and liberalism was in this sort of relaxed early Obama era mood of optimism. And I also replaced Bill Kristol, who was sort of, you know, was hated by liberals on very different grounds for his role in supporting the Iraq War. So I think for all of those reasons, there was no sort of, and there was no internet outrage culture to go back and find things that I'd written and attack them. So for all of those reasons, I could sort of, you know, enter without this level of controversy. And then, you know, and then I've worked for liberal publications my whole career. So I have a very clear sense, I think, of to what extent you can sort of write in dialogue in ways that allow people who don't agree with you to give you a hearing and not assume that you're a bigot and a troglodyte. And the challenge is, if you're hiring people from conservative publications, you're hiring people who haven't spent their lives sort of doing that very careful thing, walking that tightrope. And so they're going to have things in their paper trail, you know, that sort of wouldn't fly as columns for more or arguments for a more liberal readership. Now, with that being said, though, you know, I think about, I don't know how long ago, 2 months ago, maybe less, I wrote a column arguing that liberals should be willing to negotiate with Stephen Miller, even though they might think of him as a white nationalist, because immigration restrictionism is a part of American politics that isn't going away. There are reasonable cases to be made for it. And you can actually maybe hash out a more plausible, lasting deal on immigration with someone like him at the table than you would just by putting people who already agree on the issue in the room, as past immigration deals have tried to do. And that column did get me accused of being a, you know, either normalizing white nationalism, normalizing racism, if not being a racist or a Nazi myself. And it wasn't the same level of outrage that some other things have generated, but it was sort of slotted in as an example of, you know, the Times is becoming a newspaper that enables Nazis, and Richard Spencer is shifting the Overton window, and so on. So, you know, I'm not, you know, I obviously don't think that my column was an example of sort of white nationalist propaganda, but I'm not going to sort of persuade people otherwise in an interview with you. But I think it's an example of how sort of it doesn't, you know, this is a very fraught moment in American politics, and people are on edge. And I think there it's a case, too, of where the link to Trump really mattered. I think if I had written the same column in a general way, as I've done many times, and said, here are the arguments for sort of moderate restrictionism on immigration, here is why we shouldn't necessarily expand the immigration rate, readers wouldn't have gotten upset. But because I was saying liberals or centrists should be willing to negotiate with the Trump White House, and particularly this sort of figure that people consider noxious, Stephen Miller, it did get that kind of reaction, which is in turn a case study in the challenges that we were talking about earlier, that a literal pro-Trump columnist would obviously face in writing for an audience like the Times's.
Well, that was my least favorite column of yours in a very long time. So maybe we've hit upon the germ of a difference here. I mean, I guess just to go back, you said something interesting, which was that you said that because you'd been writing for liberal publications, you knew, I think you said two things. One is that you knew kind of how to phrase your argument in such a way that liberals would listen to, but it also meant that you wouldn't sort of go past certain lines the way maybe writers at conservative magazines like the National Review or somewhere else would not quite know. And am I paraphrasing that okay?
Sure. Arguments written for people who disagree with you are inevitably more careful and, let's say, polite than arguments written for people who agree with you.
Well, right. But I also thought you were saying, and maybe this is wrong, that the standards of what, you know, you were going to say about, not you, take you out of it, but the standards that someone would write about a racial issue or something, and sort of trying to be sensitive about that or non-bigoted or whatever term you want, would be higher at a place like The Times than they might be at conservative publications. And it seems to me that that's true, and that that's also probably a good thing, and that part of the frustration is that, you know, National Review for many years had a man called John Derbyshire write for them. And I think when both of us were coming up in journalism, who would write these awful things very frequently. And that essentially that having these types of standards that liberal institutions have, which people like to make fun of as being overly politically correct or, you know, everyone's walking on eggshells, there is a certain value in sort of enforcing the idea that we're going to talk about these things in certain ways, and not to say that people shouldn't have the right to talk about them in other ways, but that the people we want to give platforms to will talk about them in certain ways.
Yeah, and I think that's reasonable, but I also think that there is a, you know, there's a zone of left-right disagreement about where racial sensitivity becomes racism versus where, you know, it becomes sort of having an, on the other side, having an honest conversation about race. And I think, you know, as someone who I write movie reviews for National Review, but I, you know, I'm not a sort of spokesman for National Review in any way, but they've, you know, including in the Derbyshire era, they've published pieces on race where I think, you know, the sort of racial insensitivity could shade into something more toxic, Derbyshire being an example. And, but of course, Derbyshire was ultimately jettisoned from National Review. For a piece he didn't write for them, but that he wrote for a more sort of racist tolerant website, I guess you might say. I guess my point is just that it's fine for liberal publications to have standards. It's fine for any publication to have standards, and clearly there are, you know, there are people who might write for a conservative publication and whose views it would be totally reasonable for liberals to not want to publish in their publication. I'm just skeptical, again, of an approach that says, you know, we're going to look at your whole body of work and find places where, you know, where you cross the line. I think that that approach, again, doesn't do justice to the, you know, the real complexity of a full writing career.
I should also say that I started journalism, or basically started journalism, in a place called The New Republic, which when I started working there was owned by a man with some very toxic political views. And so this is not purely a left-right issue, since that was broadly a liberal magazine. In the interest of full disclosure, I feel like I should say that. But Ross Douthat, the book is To Change the Church, Pope Francis and the Future of Catholicism. It is available wherever you buy books. Ross, thank you so much for coming in.
Absolutely. Thank you for having me on.
And that's our show for today. I Have to Ask is produced by Max Jacobs. Thanks to Nika Singh and Northgate Studios here in Berkeley. And thanks also for help from Jason DeLeon at Slate in Brooklyn. If you have an idea for a guest or you just want to let me know your thoughts, email me at ask@slate.com. That's ask@slate.com. You can also follow me at Twitter @iChotner to get information about the show.